Judge Santel, Judge Griffith, Judge Garland, good afternoon. I'm Michael Zinser, and I represent the Register Guard. I'm here this afternoon to ask the court just to do two things. I'm going to cover two points. One is going to be the May 5, 2000 discipline of Guild President Prozanski, and then I will later address the special circumstances issue with respect to District Manager Ron Cangill. First, with respect to President Prozanski, it's our contention that the May 4, 2000 email is nearly identical to the August emails, which the National Labor Relations Board.
Your first contention that that's not properly within the complaint, isn't it? The May communication?
Yes, Your Honor. And
you look surprised. I thought that was your first line of defense, that it was untimely.
I was going to get to that, Your Honor, but yes, that is absolutely one of the guard's positions, that there never was a...
Just getting to that I'm not sure why you didn't start there. If you went on that, then that one's out of the picture, right?
Yes, Your Honor. No unfair labor practice charge was ever filed with respect to that particular email. That was raised in our answer before the administrative law judge at the hearing. With respect to that issue, the board argues that it's somehow related to the August emails, and I would just assert that I think the fact that the board itself treated the emails differently.
Yeah, the board treated them differently, and they are in fact different, right?
Absolutely, they're different. Absolutely.
Did you make this argument? That is the, I think it's footnote one of the ALJ's opinion says that it falls within the exception for closely related, I think. I'm trying to figure out what, find the, it is in the ALJ's opinion that the ALJ addresses this argument of yours, right? Yes, it's footnote one says it's the closely related test, right?
Yes, and our position is it's not close.
No, that's your position, but did you make that argument to the board that it doesn't fit within, or to us even, that it doesn't fit within the closely related test?
We made the argument to the court that because of the statute of limitations,
right,
and the no unfair labor practice charge was filed.
You made the argument that at 6 months came too late.
Yes, Your Honor.
And they responded, and the ALJ responded, well, there's an exception, the closely related test. And you did not again respond. That is, you didn't challenge the closely related test argument, or did you? The opposing counsel says you didn't, so I'm assuming for the purpose of, at least unless you tell me otherwise, that you didn't argue to the board that it satisfied under, what's it called, Red 1, under the National Labor Relations Board, and under our own cases, drug plastics. You didn't make that argument, and you didn't make that argument to us.
I don't believe I made that specific argument to you, but I did make the statute of limitations argument.
Yeah, you made that argument.
And that no unfair labor practice charge was filed. And in response to, in our reply brief, with respect to the closely related argument that the board made, I believe we did address that in our reply brief. But with respect to closely related, the May email addressed anarchists showing up at a union rally. The August emails deal with a totally different subject matter and totally different activities. With respect to the substance of the May 4th email, there's no question that the Ms. Prozanski was acting in her capacity as the Guild president. The email itself talks about the Guild would like to set the record straight. The Guild first heard. The Guild passed on incomplete information. Signs at yours in solidarity, like the August emails. Later on, acknowledges that she used the email system on behalf of the Guild. I should have known better.
The rule was not against using it on behalf of the Guild. The rule is against Lou using it for solicitation, right?
Well, on behalf of any organization.
Right. Solicitation is what I'm asking you about, right?
Solicitation and proselytizing.
Right. The May one was neither one, was it?
Oh, no, the May one was clearly proselytizing.
Not clear to me. Make that clear to me, counsel.
Well, what the union was what the guild president was trying to do was to persuade the union members to move from one position to another with respect to the anarchist issue, and that's exactly what it was trying to sell them on. The
stretched definition of solicitation.
No, I'm talking proselytizing.
I don't think proselytizing is in the rule, is it? Am I?
It absolutely
it
is.
It is, okay.
It absolutely
is. Even so, what is she proselytizing? What group is she proselytizing them to join at that point? That doesn't sound like any definition of proselytizing I ever heard.
Well,
you said we were wrong in some facts we told you a while ago. That's proselytizing?
I believe an accepted definition of that term, Your Honor, is to try to sell somebody or to move somebody from one position to another, and that's exactly what the guild president was trying to do with respect to the anarchist issue. And like the August emails, it was a mass email sent to at least 50 employees. And as the board found, there is no evidence that any other organization that an employee has been able to use the system.
Fairly normal definition of proselytize has to be to attempt to convert or recruit a person. I don't ever remember hearing proselytize used to try to change somebody within an organization from an inaccurate factual viewpoint to a more accurate factual viewpoint. Can you give me an example where that's ever been used that way?
Your Honor, I think on the face of the emails that the guild president is trying to move them from one.
I'm talking about the definition of proselytize. This doesn't sound like proselytizing to me. Unless you can give me some example where it's being used that way. In this context, this proselytizing includes trying to tell somebody we were wrong about the facts, so this is what really happened? That's proselytizing?
I believe that it is, Your Honor.
Okay.
I just wonder, Mr. Zinser, whether the reason you're having problems with this is that she was not punished for proselytizing. She was punished for using it for a purpose mm-hmm. other than company business.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that the real problem that you had and the real reason she was punished?
Well, the policy.
Yeah.
Says
the policy
the system
says
cannot
solicitation.
Be used or proselytizing.
I got it. But the letters that you sent, the May 5th letter, which is at Joint Appendix 130, and the interoffice memo, which is at 131 and 132, say, in the first one, May 5th, that we're doing this because we don't want people to assume it's okay to use the company's email for purposes other than company business, not that it's okay to use it for proselytizing. And in the letter of, in the memo of August, in which Ms. Walden is going back over what happened in May 5th, she says, you agreed you would refrain from using the company's system for union/personal business. So it's not, the objection was not, that you would stop using the system for dissemination of union information. So, in fact, she was being punished not for solicitation, but merely using it for non-business purposes.
For using it on behalf of an outside organization.
Well, I actually don't see any of those words in there either.
That's not in the policy. Nothing in the policy says you can't use it on behalf of. It refers specifically to solicitation and proselytizing.
Are not to be used to solicit or proselytize for commercial ventures, religious or social causes, outside organizations, or other non-job related.
Right. You can't solicit or proselytize. It doesn't say you can't use it on behalf of any of those groups. It says not to be used for solicitation or proselytizing. That's all it says. You read it yourself just then.
On behalf of outside organizations.
Right. Solicitation or proselytizing on behalf of outside organizations. It doesn't say no use.
It doesn't say on behalf of outside. That's one example. It says or other non-job-related solicitations. It seems to me that there is a pretty large distinction between the different descriptions of what the policy here is. And I think the reason you're having difficulty defending this on the solicitation ground is that doesn't appear to have been the actual, that may have been the written policy, but that doesn't appear to be the way you were applying it in this particular case.
Well, and that's what the National Labor Relations Board found below, and I believe that was correct with respect to the August emails, and I'm arguing here this afternoon that with respect to the May email.
If you're arguing to us that the May email is same as the August one, right?
Same in character. Right.
So that's good if you win one of them. That's pretty bad if you lose one of them, because it means you lose the other two, right? So your position is you have to win both, since they're the same. It's both or neither.
It's our position that all three emails.
All three, right. But I'm talking August and May.
We're in violation of the policy.
And either they all were or none of them were, because they're the same. That's your argument. That's what you got up here, and your opening statement was there's no difference between the May and the August emails, right?
I absolutely said the May email is similar in character to the August emails.
Right.
We're sent out on behalf of the organization in violation of the policy. Quickly, with respect to Mr. Cangale, we certainly...
Well, I'm not going to let you get into that, I don't think, unless my colleagues want to talk to you about it. But on the timeliness argument, what's the best argument that you have saved this argument for us on the untimeliness of the May 5th, the May mailing, the May emails? Judge Garland questioned whether it's properly before us.
There's no doubt that you raised the timeliness. The thing that I'm not seeing is a response to the argument of a close relationship, closely related.
Well, and I believe we addressed that, and when the board raised it, we addressed that in a reply brief.
But did you raise it before the board? I guess is my first question. Did you make that argument to the board at all?
Go ahead.
I believe it's in our exceptions, and I believe we did. Your Honor, that's to the best of my memory, we did.
Actually, when you come back up on rebuttal, if you could tell me the part in the reply brief, too, that would be helpful. Thanks.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the union.
May it please the court, I'm Jim Coppas on behalf of the Eugene Newspaper Guild. The issue that we're addressing in our petition for review is the second one decided by the board here.
Yeah, you also appear as intervener on the other issue.
Yes, that's true.
Okay, go ahead.
I hadn't asked for any time on that, but if you have any questions in our role.
Yeah, while you're up here, I might ask you something about that.
I would be happy to answer them.
Okay.
The issue that the board decided that we're addressing is whether the Register Guard violated Section 8A1 by discriminatorily enforcing the newspaper's communication systems policy against union-related emails while allowing some personal emails. And in deciding that issue, the board stated that what it was doing was, quote, adopting the position of the court in Guardian and Fleming that unlawful discrimination consists of disparate treatment of activities or communications of a similar character because of their union status. And the court also recognized that's the same definition of discrimination that this court has applied in NLRA cases. What the courts have done in applying the definition that the board purported to follow here was insist that the question of whether different communications are similarly situated be decided on the basis, to use the Seventh Circuit's words, in respect that the law deems relevant. Here, the board recognized that a wide variety of employee emails had been allowed on non-business purposes. Indeed, many of them met the board's definition of solicitation in that they called for action by the employees. Yet the only emails that were punished were those that were union-related. And the express basis for the punishment in the company's disciplinary letters was that the emails were union-related. But the board held that that nevertheless didn't constitute anti-union discrimination because there were no examples of organization-related emails. But in distinguishing all of the allowed emails, which also violated the literal terms of the company's policy and the company's interpretation of the policy, if you take the disciplinary notices at their word, the board didn't explain why that made any difference at all, the organizational aspect. And indeed, it's hard to see how it could have here. The policy barred all non-job-related solicitations. The company's stated interpretation was that it barred all non-business uses. And in that respect, the union emails were indistinguishable from the other emails that were allowed. There's also no distinction in terms of disruptive effect. The union emails, as we pointed out in our brief, were, if anything, less likely to be disruptive than the other employee emails that were allowed. And finally, there's no distinction in terms of the company's practice. So we're, in terms of the board's opinion, at a loss to see what was legally relevant about the organizational connection that the board relied on. This court addressed a similar attempt to distinguish union solicitations in the context of broad no solicitation rules in the Restaurant Corporation case, and rejected the notion that it provided grounds for distinguishing union emails that would violate a rule from other emails that were allowed based on the nature of the union communications. Rather, the court insisted that there be some legally irrelevant ground for distinction, and if it couldn't be distinguished in terms of the rule, then it needed to be distinguished on grounds such as disruptive effect. And again, the board hasn't done anything like that here, nor has it attempted to even do so in its opinion or in its brief to this court. It just doggedly refuses to explain why the organizational component is relevant. The Seventh Circuit reached the same conclusion in the St. Margaret Mercy case as this court did in Restaurant Corporation. So in short, we think that what the board was called upon to do here was explain why the union emails that were punished were different in some legally relevant respect, and the board has so far failed to do that.
I want to ask you then some about your appearance as intervener on the other questions. On the insignia argument, are you contending that that was an unfair labor practice for the company to tell somebody who's going out and calling on the public, trying to sell advertising, that he can't wear a conspicuous insignia on a controversial subject? Is the board right about that?
Yes, I would say for two reasons. First of all, the company allowed people in this position to go out wearing all sorts of insignia. The testimony is quite clear on that. There was no uniform.
I'm not sure why that's relevant. I mean, you could, if you're running a law firm and you're sending an associate out to a meeting where you think you might pick up some legal business, you might be perfectly happy for him to have on something that says he went to Columbia Law School or something, but you would not necessarily want him to be wearing a McCain for President badge if he was going out meeting with union officials. I don't see why it's relevant that they could wear sporting equipment, sporting team endorsements, and couldn't wear a controversial insignia.
Well, the company's claim is that it was worried that it would imply bias in the company's reporting.
Yeah, but it's not only their claim. Doesn't that make a world of sense?
Well, no, it doesn't actually. In terms of the sports insignia, I mean, people are probably more likely to be worried about their bias in sports reporting than they are to assume that the company is going to report in a biased manner in favor of
the union. Really have to decide it, or does the board even have the power to decide that? Why can't an employer decide, I don't want my people who are out trying to sell something for me aligning themselves with another cause that might be controversial when they're trying to sell my product?
Well, there is a line of cases about that that says that if the employer is trying to present a certain image and it has rules that say that you can, you know, people have to dress a certain way and present themselves a certain way.
But isn't that inherent in sending somebody out to sell advertising?
But this employer didn't do that. It allowed this person, first of all, I don't think this person was selling, or secondly, I guess at this point, that he was selling advertising.
What was he doing?
This is the guy that supervises the carriers. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was a kid, he's the guy that was in the shop when the newsboys came in and told them, you know, to bundle up their papers and take them out. And then if he got complaints, he dealt with the customers, but mainly he's dealing with the carriers. And the company exhibited no concern about how these people dressed. And indeed, in this instance, in terms of dress, he's just wearing a green armband. It doesn't really say much of anything.
Then why did you want to wear it?
Well, it probably...
If it didn't say anything, he wouldn't want to wear it.
No, I mean, where it was meaningful, and the testimony indicated this, was to other people inside the newspaper. The only reaction that the person got from all of this was one of the carriers said, so I saw you guys have a contract dispute, how's it going? It's meaningful internally. It's not likely to move someone, you know, in the general public. But the employer didn't exhibit any concern about how people dressed other than to this union insignia. And the law's pretty clear.
Well, is there any indication that there's actually any other controversial insignia that somebody wanted to wear?
Well, there's no indication that this was controversial. The sign, which is the only thing that said anything, just said fair contract. That's probably not even controversial to the newspaper. They probably are taking the position that they've offered a fair contract. It's not like the sorts of cases where people are saying things that are rude and
the Hormel strike, or
right,
saying,
yeah,
this
right.
To you.
You know, it's not like that. This is pretty dignified, pretty neutral. So that line of cases doesn't apply. The uniform line of cases doesn't apply, and I think that they just don't have any cases that they can rely on.
There's no written policy at all on this. Is that right?
That's right. I think that's right. Nothing strict.
What action did the company take with respect to the armband?
Well, you told them not to wear it.
You told them not to wear it. So why would there have to be a written policy? I mean,
well,
they didn't say we're punishing you for wearing it. They just said don't wear it.
Well, they ordered it. I mean, all of a sudden, the only thing that they tell people not to wear is a union insignia. And the only apparent
reason... Did they tell people not to wear it, or did they tell him not to wear it?
Well, him.
I mean, it was me. He could wear it at the printing plant.
Right.
Right. They just told him don't wear it out there amongst the public, right?
Well, or amongst the carriers who are essentially employees of the newspaper. Did you have a question about the statute of limitations point? Do you wanted to ask me too, or just?
I think we just had a question for your opposing counsel on that one. Unless I don't want to speak necessarily for my colleagues, but I didn't have anything to ask you.
Okay.
About
I was going to try and say for.
Go ahead. If you got something else to do.
No, you got time.
Give it to us. What is it you had in mind?
I ran through my whole spiel. I thought that I would just save time for rebuttal if you have no questions.
Well, if you got something else to say about the. Statute of limitations, tell us.
Well, it's just that the charge was filed within 4 months of the May event, so there's no question of meeting the six-month statute of limitations.
Well, if the charge had included the May event, then...
Well, that's the issue that Judge Garland was asking about. That's not a statute of limitations.
That's the thing that's the issue, is whether that's an exception.
Right, and that's not a statute of limitations.
Actually, it is, because if it doesn't come within that charge, then within the stated charge, then it is outside the statute.
Well, then there's no charge, period, is the issue there.
Beg your pardon?
There's no charge, period,
right.
But that's not a statute of limitations issue.
Thank you,
thank you.
You got plenty for rebuttal. Don't worry about that. We'll hear from the board.
Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is Heather Beard, and I represent the National Labor Relations Board. The board is seeking enforcement of its order against Register Guard and asks this court to affirm its dismissal of the union's challenges to the board's decision. Now, although both the company and the union take different challenges to the board's decision, both of them have failed to meet their similarly high burden of overcoming the board's reasonable interpretation of the law in this case, as well as the facts in this case. So to begin, talking about the company's challenge to the board's finding with regard to the May 4th email and the May 5th.
Let me ask you something that's even more fundamental and preliminary. I'm a bit confused as to why the board would go about adopting the Seventh Circuit test here when it had its own cases on point. Richmond Times Dispatch and the DuPont case are both board precedents involving emails, and there isn't. There's nary a mention of them in the board's opinion. They just seem to gloss over them completely. I mean, there is reference to, you know, we've considered our precedents, but then it goes on and adopts this Seventh Circuit test without saying anything about its existing precedent. Why isn't that a failure of analysis by the board? They haven't given us a reasoned justification for departing from their current precedent.
Well, first of all, I believe there was a reasoned justification throughout the course of the decision. However, no
departing from the precedent? They didn't even talk about the precedent.
They did. They talked about the precedent, that being the underlying board decisions in Fleming and Guardian, which were reversed, by the Seventh Circuit in those cases.
They didn't talk about, here you've got, they didn't say anything about Richmond Times Dispatch, right?
That is correct.
They didn't say anything about DuPont, I don't think.
Well, the board didn't say anything about those particular cases. However, the board's overruling of its precedents in Fleming and Guardian, which were cases involving employer equipment, which is the type...
Those are bulletin boards. Here you've got board precedent involving these very facts, emails. I just find it strange that they didn't refer to them at all.
The board found more persuasive that one thing that wasn't challenged here by the union at all, which is the fact that emails should be treated more like employer equipment and property than they should be treated more like oral solicitation.
Doesn't it strike you as odd that when the board's looking for a rule here, they adopt cases from the Seventh Circuit dealing with bulletin boards and say nothing about their own cases involving emails? I just find that curious, and they don't seem to grapple with that at all.
Well, first of all, no party has raised any sort of challenge to the board not properly explaining or giving a reasoned justification for the rule that it adopted in the equipment context with regard to employee use of employer's email. But secondly, I do believe that discussing, as the board does extensively, the underlying principles of Fleming and Guardian, which stem from two bulletin board cases, in addition to the whole first part of the board's decision, which again, no one has challenged, analogizing reasonably email to employer equipment, that what the board is essentially doing is saying, we believe that our cases going forward in the email context and other types of employer equipment should be analyzed under our line of cases that decided that employer equipment is not, there is no Section 7 right to utilize an employer's equipment in a completely different context. And so the board reasoned this after first finding that there was no right to utilize the employer's equipment, and then also determining that in this instance, there was no evidence that there were similarly situated emails that were permitted to make out a case of discrimination. And so, therefore, the board did make a reasoned justification throughout the course of its decision as to why it was now going to adopt in equipment cases this test, that it was going to make sure, as the Seventh Circuit said in Guardian and Fleming, it was going to make sure that like equals like, and that simply because there are some instances of...
Why couldn't they use Richmond Times-Dispatch? What was wrong with that? They didn't explain what was wrong with it. What do you think is wrong with it? Why not? It's
good. Well, first of all, the board can, as it was all five of its members were sitting after an oral argument and after reasoned consideration, very, very much decided that they were no longer going to consider email as something that the test for email actually was going to be something stricter, given the fact that it's going to be treated as property, and it's not going to be treated along the same lines of oral solicitation cases that the earlier cases in email and bulletin boards such as Fleming and Guardian and Richmond Times were talking about. The board made a more nuanced description of discrimination in the context of this case, which is employer equipment. And employer equipment in this case encompassed the emails. Thus, the earlier cases that the board decided that involved emails now, as the board explained, are going to be decided under this new reasoned standard that the board gave in its opinion.
Does the new reasoned standard apply to the telephones on people's desks?
Yes, the telephones on people's desk, as the board said.
So somebody from the outside can't call an employee for any reason other than business, and the employee would have to hang up. Is that right?
Well, on these facts, the employer didn't always enforce the letter of the law of its policy. And what the board does, it accounts for that. And the board recognized that even in Fleming, it was the actual practice that was looked toward. And so in your hypothetical about someone calling, if someone was calling in the one hand about a matter that was involved with the union and the company was to discriminate against that, and there was evidence of that in that they had allowed other individuals and they knew about other individuals being called on other types of...
Didn't the board just sort of make this up? That is, the board doesn't have a policy that says, I mean, the employer doesn't have a policy that says organizations versus non-organizations. That's not a policy that's in the written. It's just a policy that the board post hoc made up to support what the employer did.
Well, I would disagree. The policy itself talks about organizations. That's correct.
It talks about soliciting and proselytizing.
It talks about soliciting and proselytizing, but then when they actually punish the first person, they don't use soliciting versus proselytizing. They use personal versus business.
Right. And what the focus is, and this was in the Fleming case as well, is what is the actual practice of the company? And that's sort of the line that the company draws without regard to, well, I shouldn't
what
say.
What is the line the company draws? Which line?
The line between discrimination the line between the types of emails that are allowed.
What is that line?
That line is any, as long as it is neutral and on the grounds that does not.
Neutral, what do you mean by neutral? Not solicitation?
Neutral, not solicitation.
Back up just a minute. We're asking now, I think, about the line the company drew as to what it allowed and didn't draw. I think you're veering over into what the board is drawing. Tell us what line it appears the company drew.
The company drew a line in two ways we can look at it. The first is under writing its policy. I agree with you there. And in that policy, it does not say organization versus non-organization. That's number one. The company also, secondly, drew a line when it decided to discipline Ms. Przanski for those August emails. And the line that it was drawing there is, you are not, the emails did not have to do with job-related activity, and they were solicitations. And the
that's not what the letter said. If the letter said that, you would have an argument. The letters don't say that. Neither of these letters say that. The May letters say personal business. They don't say solicitation. Now, the problem here is the risk that the board is making up a distinction that is not the employer's distinction, and is trying to keep cutting the line in any way possible to put the employer on the right side of the line, even if it's not the employer's own line.
Well, I think what the board was doing is looking to see whether there was evidence that the employer's line that it drew was somehow discriminatory. And I think that's really important here and shouldn't get lost, which is the burden in this case is on the general counsel to demonstrate some form of discrimination. And on this record, when you have a company's property, which no one's challenging, is different from the oral solicitation cases, an employer has a right to prohibit Section 7 activity as long as it isn't discriminating.
Can they make up their mind each time? And so far, the only people we know are punished for anything are union members. That's the only punishment that's occurred here.
That's correct.
Now, they can't do that, right?
No, well, they can do that if the...
They can't do it because they're a union, right?
Correct.
All right. So, but how do we know if they don't have a written policy that they follow, and if they issue a series of written policies that are different, how do we know that that's not what they're doing?
Okay, well, here they didn't issue a series of written policies.
Well, they issued a letter in May, which is different than the policy because it doesn't say anything about solicitation. They issued another memo in August, which again doesn't mention the solicitation. It says just no dissemination of union information.
We would argue that despite the fact that it talks about part of the policy. It talks, as you said, about not about solicitation, but it talks about the part of the policy that is business that isn't related to the company, i.e. union business. But
we're talking about the May action,
that's right?
That's right. Which the board believes was an unlawful act, right?
That's correct.
Because it did not involve solicitation.
Disciplining her for that was
unlawful. So you can't tell me that, in fact, the August 22 one is actually okay because it's actually subtext is solicitation. We know it's wrong. We know that the August 22nd is wrong, inconsistent with its policy and discriminatory.
Well, no, I would argue that the two August emails that she sent were, unlike the May 4th email, solicitations. And the board...
No, I'm sorry. I'm talking about the memo in August,
okay,
describing the May email.
Okay, I'm with you there. So what was your, if you could... So
my question is, we now have in August, which happens to be the time of the second problem,
right,
but is a reference to what the policy is, and they're talking about you shouldn't be using this for dissemination of union information or for union/personal business.
That's correct. That's what it says in there. However, them saying that you shouldn't be using it for union business is not them necessarily saying that the problem with it is the business qua union. What they're saying is if it's non-business related, which is what the policy states, you're not allowed to do it.
The policy states solicitation. The policy states non-job related solicitation. It doesn't say non-business.
The first part of the policy, Your Honor, states that company communication systems and the equipment used to operate the communication system are owned and provided by the company to assist in conducting the business of the register guard.
Keep reading.
The communication systems are not to be used to solicit or proselytize for commercial ventures, religious or political causes, outside organizations, or other non-job related solicitations.
So the whole term of the forbidding is in terms of solicitation and proselytizing. The terms in what they said to the alleged violator was you used it for union business. They did not turn it on it being soliciting or proselytizing. Now, granted, the one in August was soliciting, but they didn't say that, did they?
Right. They didn't use the term in the disciplinary letter in August.
May, which it wasn't in May.
Right. They didn't use the language in August based upon what happened in May. That's correct. However, when what the board did which is well within the board's purview, is it took a look at the entirety of the policy, it took a look at the entirety of the circumstances in the workplace and all the different emails that had or hadn't been sent, and interpreted the policy, the company's actions, and what Ms. Przanski sent. And when it did that, it reasoned that very, we would submit, which is a very reasoned decision, that one email was an unlawful, it was unlawful to discipline Ms. Przanski for one of the emails, and that for the other two emails, in the context of its new rule with regard to employer equipment, in the context of the first and second sentence of the communication systems policy, in the context of what went on in that workplace, that it was unlawful, it was rather lawful to discipline Ms. Przanski for those two August emails. So the board would submit that even though possibly if you think that it could be read another way, that this on this record and certainly on this board's reasoning, there's nothing in here to indicate that it is irrational. There's nothing in here.
It sounds like the board is going to look at all the different things that were done every time and try to find a way that draws some line that puts the union on one side and everything else on the other, even if it is not the line drawn by the employer, and even if it is not the line that has anything to do with disruption. We have rejected that, and Judge Posner rejected that after the Seventh Circuit cases you've been citing.
Right. If I could respond to that, I'd say simply because the employer draws a line in its rule and then disciplines Ms. Przanski for what you would say, another reason, does not establish discrimination. And that is what we're looking at, and that is what the board is saying. The board is saying there needs to be something more. Now, the case of Restaurant Corporation in this circuit and St. Margaret Mercy in the Seventh Circuit absolutely have reasoning involving the disruption of the workplace. However, as we made the point in our brief, in this case, in this context, we're talking about not the oral solicitation cases that were Restaurant Corporation and St. Margaret Mercy, but we're talking about employer equipment cases where the employer has the absolute right to ban the Section 7 or any act, any use of its own property as long as it's not discrimination. So here what the board did is it weighed the evidence and it found that there was no evidence that the board, that rather that the company had allowed in any other emails that were of similar that were would indicate like was treated in a dislike manner. And so for those reasons, we believe that the board's decision was reasoned and is entitled to deference, and therefore the two different emails, the findings should be upheld. Now, if I may, I'd like to address the statute of limitations argument with regard to this May 4th email. As my intervener slash opposing counsel, Mr. Kappas, illustrated, I agree, there are two different arguments here, and the either way you slice it, the company has waived the issue of whether or not this.
I don't see how they have waived an issue. They may have waived an argument, but they raised the issue of this charge not being included in the timely made charges. Now, they may not have. The question of whether this came within an exception is something that was raised by somebody else, or raised by the board, raised by the union. But as far as the issue of whether it's included, they raised the issue.
Okay.
Didn't they?
They did not raise the issue, and I'll explain why.
Okay.
What happened here is the May 4th allegation was made in the complaint. There was no charge. That is correct. Simply saying, as they do on page 23 of their exceptions brief, that no unfair labor practice charge was filed, devoid of any linkage to any legal consequence of that, is not raising the issue that it wasn't closely related, which is the only thing that matters if you're talking about a case in which there's been.
The first thing that matters is whether it is not in the complaint and it is otherwise untimely. That they have raised that, haven't they, or have they? Maybe I'm wrong about that.
They raised the issue. Let's take the untimeliness first.
They raised the issue.
When we say timeliness, we're talking about whether or not the folks who filed the unfair labor charges were on notice that the policy was being enforced. And they did raise that, and the board did address that, and we did respond in our brief that the board was, that rather the company was not enforcing its 1996 policy during the times.
You'd be better off just to admit that they raised the issue of untimeliness on the May issue and then go on to the next round, the next level on this.
They have raised the timeliness.
Yeah.
Correct. What they have not done is raised the other 10B issue. That's the other part of their procedural argument, which is because a charge was not filed, that it was improper somehow to allege it in the complaint and make a finding on that. And on those grounds, I believe my opponent is going to have to concede, because they absolutely never raised that argument after the ALJ said in footnote, I believe it's footnote one, that these are closely related. They absolutely never raised that. And so because it's not closely related, we do not think this should be something that should stymie the court in any way at this point.
I want to say something about the insignia issue.
Yes, I agree with what my intervener said. And I would also like to say that with the insignia issue, the burden is on the company to prove special circumstances. It's been stated long ago that simply because there's a chance that someone wears a button or says something about the union and goes into the public is not sufficient to show special circumstances to restrict the wearing of that union insignia. So that's what I would say with regard to that. We believe the board should be affirmed on all of its findings. Unless you have any other questions for me?
Seeing none, I will proceed to rebuttal. I believe the company was out of time, but we'll give back two more minutes and probably use more than that since we have questions to ask. Hear first from the company in rebuttal. You're through, right, counsel? Board counsel, you were through, right? Okay, good, thank you.
First, with my review, since I've had time to be up here, I do not find that we raised the closely related issue in the reply brief. However, the closely related issue is something that the board must demonstrate to get around the fact that there was not an unfair labor practice charge filed with respect to the May 4, 2000 email.
And the ALJ did make that finding, and the board adopted the findings. Footnote one, the ALJ made the finding. In the boards, they got the usual boilerplate footnote that says everything we haven't discussed, we adopted. And so the next step is you did not accept to the finding of the ALJ of closely relatedness, right? Well,
we accepted several times to the statute of limitations argument, but did not specifically use the term closely related, but there are four or five exceptions that relate to that. And the complaint in the case, you know, did not issue until June of 2001, okay? And so the email went out in May of 2000, and, you know, we didn't know until June of 2001 that they were going to be making any claim with respect to the May email. Now, with respect to the memoranda that the company used, I would just ask the court, you know, if you look at this entire record and the testimony of Cynthia Walden, it's clear that what the company was doing was trying to limit the use of its email system by outside organizations. And
it may be clear in retrospective, but it's not what the policy said that the union workers or all the workers were on notice of. It didn't say we're trying to restrict all uses. It said it can't be used for solicitation and proselytizing, didn't it?
It uses the words for outside organizations. That's right.
I'm making it broader for you. I'm not even restricting it to outside organizations. It says it can't be used for solicitation and proselytizing. That's the only verbs it forbade. Right? It didn't say you can't use it. Didn't say you can't discuss outside organizations. Didn't even say you can't support outside organizations. Say you can't solicit or proselytize. Wasn't that the only verbs in there?
Those are the words in the policy, yes, Your Honor.
And that's what the union employees or any employees were on notice of, is the company's rule against solicitation and proselytizing, right?
But I think the union president, when you look at the responses that the union president sent back to management, you know, basically, okay, look, I understand what the policy is. The president understood what the policy is, apologized, said she wouldn't do it again, and she was going to get the word out. So I think there was an understanding that it was not supposed to be used on behalf of organizations.
So and that was after the May usage, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That was all after the May usage, right?
No, the record has examples, a 1997 example.
What the president said, what you're charging the president with acknowledging, was after the May usage.
Yes, right? Your Honor. I'm sorry, I misunderstood. Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
I think your time is up unless my colleagues have further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Now, the union petitioner had plenty of time, so we won't give you any more. No good deed goes unpunished, Mr. Coppins.
I'll cede some of it back to the court. Okay. The company's policy prohibits all non-job-related solicitations, and that's the part the board identified as the relevant portion here.
Solicitation.
The record reflects that there were many, many non-job-related solicitations in the email sent out, and the only ones that were ever punished were the union.
The thing I usually question, and I do now, is how much is there in there to show that the company was attention was called to those other solicitations?
Well, the exact...
It doesn't say too much if they didn't punish it, if nobody above the level of grade one or whatever knew about it.
Baker, who I think was the managing editor who issued the first disciplinary notice, testified that he received many of them. I think the exhibits show many, many people getting them. The company has never said that it didn't know that this was going on. Indeed, the only... And articulated a theory. Cynthia Walden, the human resources person, articulated an interpretation of the policy where she took different emails and she said it would be okay for an employee to respond to this email and respond to the group, but not if the person were a union officer. So it's just nothing but anti-union discrimination, and all the board majority had to say
what
about it.
Who was that last person?
Cynthia Walden, I think her name was. She's the human resources person. She was the company's chief witness. We cited this in our brief a couple of times, the portion. And the board, after the fact, just says, well, you have no evidence of any other organizations having sent solicitation. It doesn't offer any explanation as to why that's relevant. And I think board counsel's confirmed today that it's not possible to articulate a reason that would be relevant, and that's what the board needs to do in order to find that all these other similar emails are dissimilar from the union ones that were punished. If there are no questions.
Seeing none.
Okay, thank you very much.
Case is submitted. Give us a recess.